So we are at the end of Perek Yud Chet, at the end of chapter 18. To recap the story, because it's been a while, the story began back in Perek Yud Zayin in chapter 17, when we had a young man, we're not sure exactly what his age is, by the name of Micha. And Micha, well, really, the story starts with Micha's mother, in truth. Micha's mother is upset because money is missing. The money apparently has been stolen, at least one way to read the sentence. And Micha tells his mother, no, I have the money. Whether he's saying, I took it for household needs, or whether he's saying, I stole it, is unclear in the story. But he says, I have the money with me, and here it is. And she blesses her son, but he says to her, this money that you issued a curse about, you declared a curse against whoever took it. So she says back, excuse me, my son should be blessed to God. He gives her the money, and she says, I have declared this money holy to God. It should be used to make a statue, which is not what we would think of for something, money that's holy to God, that it should be used for a statue, but that's what she says. And she says, I'm giving it back to you. You go make the statue. And he is not interested. He gives it back to her and says, you make the statue. And in the end, the statue is made, and it becomes part of Micha's Beit Elohim, his house for God. And what we explained at the time is that there are two ways to take this story.
Is that the same as Michahu?
Same person, correct. He stops being Michahu, he starts being Micha once he makes the statue. We talked about it a little bit in the beginning of the story, but yeah, that's okay. So there are two ways to take this story. One way to take the story is that this is actually a statue for Avodah Zarah. It's for idolatry, and the way to take, therefore, the word Elohim every time it shows up here is Elohim. It's really, it's not God. It's an idol that's being worshipped.
What's the evidence for that?
The evidence that it's idolatry? Just the fact that, generally speaking, idols tend to be.
But the Elohim, Elohim.
Well, that's what it would then mean. In other words, if someone is referring to an idol as God, from a Jewish perspective, I view it as not. So therefore, I would say Elohim rather than Elohim. That's the evidence.
So Elohim is the idol and Elohim is our?
No, Elohim would be what I would say if I'm referring to an idol, because it's not holy. There's no Kedusha, there's no holiness to it. So I would just say Elohim. Whereas if I'm talking about God, then it becomes a name with Kedusha, with holiness, and so therefore I would say Elohim. Elohim, exactly.
I'm sorry, I also don't
understand that. I would have thought
vice versa. Because normally we say Elohim.
Right, except right, so the general rule is there are seven names of God which are considered holy names, and are not supposed to be pronounced for nothing. Like it says in the third of our Aseret HaDibrot, the third of the Ten Commandments, not to take Hashem's name in vain. So we don't say it except as part of prayer or as part of a pasuk, a verse in the Torah. But otherwise we avoid it. So if it is... So if this name has Kedusha, has holiness, then I'm not going to pronounce it with the full name. I'm going to say Elohim. But if the name is mundane, it's a reference to an idol, then I'm just going to say Elohim and not have any concerns.
So in other words, it's not forbidden, and that means that it's
correct.
That it's not real.
Correct.
But it's when it's forbidden, you say it differently.
Correct.
Okay.
You got it. Okay. So that's one way to take it. The other way to take it is that this is an example of syncretism, of the Jews in Israel having gone native, having absorbed elements of what the Canaanites around them are doing, and so they believe they're worshipping Hashem. They believe they're worshipping the Jewish God, and they have simply borrowed elements from the religions among them, including making statues. But they believe it's actually for God. And there's a lot to recommend that read of the story, as we're going to see momentarily, because Micha sets up this idol, and then he has a visitor, the young man who is a Levi. He's described as a young man, as a Nar. He has been living in Beit Lechem Yehuda. We don't know exactly why he had been living there, if he is in fact a Levi. We had a lot of discussion about this. Is he a Levi or is he from Yehuda? Is his family a mixture of Leviim and from Yehuda? I'm not going to reopen that topic right now because it doesn't affect the rest of the story. But he had been living in Yehuda, and now he is migrating. He's looking for a place to live and work. I'm out of sheets. Sorry. He's looking for a place to live and work. He stops off in the house, and Micha says to him, "This is wonderful. You can come be my Kohen. God is going to be very happy that I have a Levi to work in my house." Which betrays, first of all, a misunderstanding of the way Leviim work, because the Kohanim, the subset of the family of Levi, are the ones that work, not all of the Leviim. The Leviim, in general, have certain jobs, and then the Kohanim are the ones who really are the ones who have the higher job of serving God. But number two, it supports the idea that this is intended to be a Jewish house of worship, because otherwise, why would he care about whether he has a Levi or not? So he persuades Micha. Micha at first does not want to go. And we read the verses there, the psukim there, in different ways. But basically it sounds like he's up for a bribe. So first he says, stay with me for a couple of days. He feeds him. Then he promises him he'll give him new clothing and he'll give him a salary. And he says, okay, fine, I'll stay. And that was the end of chapter 17. Chapter 18 introduced us to the tribe of Dan. We had noted when we started this story that this story does not take place at the end of the period of the Shoftim. There is a minority view that thinks it does, but generally speaking, it is assumed this story actually took place in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim. And we had various reasons for why it's put at the end of the book. One reason is to demonstrate how the Jews have fallen throughout this period. Look at this terrible thing that happens, as you'll see. And that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it was because there were elements that connected this with the story of Shimshon that precedes it in the book, and so it made sense to put them together. But however you read it, the story is occurring likely in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, and that's important to note because of what comes next. The tribe of Dan has not conquered their land, or they don't have enough room in their land, and they decide, we would like to take some more land in the northeast. Dan's area is near the shore, southwest, and they decide, we're going to go northeast up to the area called the Bashan, which is east of the Jordan and way north.
Uh-oh, we've seen that again.
Sorry?
We've seen that again.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So they want to go venture northeast. They send out a group of five men as their reconnaissance team. They pass through the area. They recognize the sound of the voice of this Levi. And we talked about last time what it is that they recognize. How do they recognize this? Either Leviim had a certain dialect, or they hear him singing in his service in the temple, or maybe they knew him. Right? It's possible that they knew him. We talked about the cities where the Leviim lived and whether he could have actually been somebody they knew beforehand. But fundamentally, they recognize him and they say to him, what are you doing here? What do you do? What is there for you here? And we noted last time something that will be important when we start moving into new material. These questions that they ask are really important. They seem to be three versions of the same question. And so what we saw was, in the Midrash, the idea that these questions are actually a veiled reference to something else, which we're going to come back to later. I'm not going to reopen it right now. There's more going on in these questions than it sounds like. And he says to them, well, you know, Micha hired me, and now I have become a Kohen in his household. And they go on their merry way. They go up to a place called Laish. It's also called Leshem when this story of them conquering this land appears in Yahushua, because that story, it is referenced there as well. But they go up to this area and they find that the people there are unsuspecting. The people there are sitting innocently, peacefully. They don't think they're under any threat. They don't live near anybody else. The Jews are not a threat to them because these people are not in the land of Canaan. So therefore, we have no reason to be going up there. They're nice, peaceful people. They're merchants. They govern themselves. There isn't even a king, we said. There's nobody there who tells them what to do. They're just sort of self-governing, right? Abarbanel said it seems to be some form of democracy that's going on. And they come back these five people come back to the rest of the tribe and say, this is great. We can conquer them in a day. No problem. We'll be able to take new land. Everything will be wonderful. That was in the middle of Perek Yichet, chapter 18. And so, the tribe ventures north, this time with 600 men, and they're going to attack the city of Laish / Leshem. But along the way, they stop off at this house of idolatry or whatever it is that Micha is running. And that was the last bit that we did. If you take a quick look at Perek Yudchet Pasuk Chaf Aleph, chapter 18, sentence 21. That was the, we'll just go through the psukim, the verses quickly, because this matters. Vayifnu vayelech. Okay? Sorry, I need to go back a little bit further. I started in the middle of it. Go back to Pasuk Yuchet, sentence 18. This group, the 600 men, have arrived at the house of Micha. Chapter 18, sentence 18. In Shoftim, make sure you're in Shoftim. Ve'ele bo'u beis Micha. They came to the house of Micha. Ve'ikhu es pesel ha'efod ves ha'trafim ves ha'masecha. They took the statue, they took the trafim, which we talked about, whether they're idolatrous, not idolatrous, it's some form of human form. They took everything. By all the various elements of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry or whatever this is. By Omar Aleim HaKohen, and the Kohen says to them, he still doesn't have a name, Ma Temosim, what are you doing? Vayomru lo, and they said to him in Pasuk Yotet, sentence 19, Hachareish, they said, be quiet. Sim Yotcha al Picha, put your hand on your mouth, which is something that we find in Navi, in Nach in general, for when someone is holding his speech. Literally, you know, he puts his hand up to his mouth, like, I'm not going to say anything. That's what they tell him to do. Velech imanu, and come with us. Veheye lanu la'avu l'chohen. And you could be for us a mentor. You could be for us a kohen. Hatove yoscha kohen lebeis ish echad. Ove yoscha kohen l'sheyon l'mishpacha b'Yisrael. Be upwardly mobile. Right? Why are you thinking small? You have this one little family thing here. Come on! We're an entire tribe. Why would you stay here? Come to the big city. That's their sales pitch. And Vayitav Leva Kohen. He says, okay. So he's such a comic figure throughout the story, this Levi. And he's meant to be that way. He's being portrayed ironically. This is, you know, I think I mentioned this one before the break. This story and the next story, which is Pilegesh B'Givah, the concubine at Givah, are meant to show the way the Jews of this time have descended so horribly and are in need of strong leadership, but they take very different tactics to get there. There is nothing funny in the next story. The story of the concubine at Givah is just horrible. This story, you can't stop laughing. You laugh at the people of Dan, you laugh at the people at Micha, and you laugh at this Levi. It's just ironic. The whole story is played for laughs, essentially, to show you just how sad things have gotten, but in a comical way.
Did they conquer that area?
That's coming next. We're not there yet. They're on their way, but they're pretty sure that this is going to succeed. They even went with their family, something that we noted last time. They brought their families with them. They don't even expect to go back home. Like, we're just going to conquer it and settle. So they take everything. Right, he goes along with it. He's carrying the stuff. I have all the karam ha'am. He goes in the midst of this nation. Pasuk chafal of sentence 21. Vayifnu vayelechu, and they went. Vayasimu es hatavas hamikneves hakvudal lifnehem, and they put their children. See that? Because they have the family. They put their children and their cattle and all their wealth. Everything is in front of them. Kvuda, by the way, this I had never noticed before, is the word used now on El Al. For carry-on bags. Carry-on bags. I had not seen that before, but I saw it this time. They put a sticker on the handbag. It's called Kvuda. Yeah, go figure. So they had Kvuda as well, and they put that in front of them, presumably under the seat. So, Hema.
So what is it? So they stole the guy's...
Yes. That's correct. And they stole the Levi. Ah, so that's the next question. Very good. Andy asked the right question. Hema herchiku mi beis Micha. They got away from the house of Micha. V'anashim asher babatim asher beis Micha niz'aku v'yad biku es b'nei Dan. And the locals, right, that was their church or whatever it was, right? The locals are all summoned. They hear this. They rally and they catch up to the people from Dan. Vayikru al bnei Dan, and they call the people of Dan. Vayasebu pneihem, who turn around. The image of they turned around is like they're not even stopping, like, you know, like looking back at them. Vayamru l'micha, they said to Micha, Malachaki nizakta, what are you making this big fuss about? Vayomer, he said, excuse me, as Elohai asher asisi lekachtem, you took my God, which I made. And that's another element that's played for laughs here, right? If it's really your God, how can somebody steal it? Notwithstanding that, you could say they don't believe it's actually the God, it's just the focus, or whatever it is, it still sounds really funny to say, you stole my God. V'yas ha-kohen, and you took the kohen. V'telchu, and you went. Umaliot, what do I have left? Umazet tumroi lai maloch, why are you even asking me what I'm upset about? V'yomer elav b'nei Dun, to which the people of Dun say, al tashma kocha imanu, don't make your voice heard with us. Pen yivgu b'chem anashim marei nefesh, people of bitter spirit might hit you. Right? You know, there are some dangerous men with us. And at that point, you know, you'll cause your own death and the death of your household. In other words, they threaten him. They say, keep quiet, or things will get much worse for you. Yes. And that's part of this story. That's part of this story. This is a story without a shofet. Right? We said, Ein melech b'Yisrael. There is no leader in Israel at this point. There is no shofet. And there is no outside enemy. It's just Jews against Jews. Yeah?
And according to Abarbanel, Shimshon was locked up then, right? Because he always said it, right?
Right, because Abarbanel is of the view that this is actually happening at this point within the book. It's not happening earlier, but he has a problem because he believes there's always a shofet. He was of the belief that the shoftim were contiguous. There is no period without. So he says it's when Shimshon is locked up among the plishtim. But the majority view is that this is simply the beginning of the period when no shofet has arisen yet. Yeshua is dead,
didn't it say,
and there is no shofet. It said, "Ein melech b'Yisrael," but the question is, how do I interpret those words? So that's what we are now up to. Pasuk Chav Zayin, sentence 27, and now they go off to Laish Taleshem up north. They took that which Micha had made, meaning the idol, and they took the kohen he had. And they come to Laish. Al am shoket uvoteach. A nation that is quiet, a nation that thinks itself secure. Vayaku osam lefi charev. And they massacred them by the sword. Ve'ez ha'ir sarfu ba'esh. And they burned the city.
Why? They could have lived in that city.
Yeah. Why do you burn the city? So what are you doing? Why did they burn the city?
No, I just read because sure to make it their communities around them that.
Maybe do it to an
extent.
Get rid of their Avodah Zarah. Sure. It would make room for the new one, right? Well, keep on reading and we're going to come back to it. I want to read through the end of the chapter and then we'll come back. It gets stranger. Ve'ein matzil, and nobody can save the people of this town. Ki rechokahi mit Sidon. The next neighbor is Sidon, right? Up in Lebanon. And they're far away. Ve'davar ein lahem im adam. They have no treaties with anybody else. We described that already when they did the surveillance in the beginning, that they don't have any treaties with anyone. It was in the valley beside Beit Rehov. The Dat Mikra says it's in the Chula. It's in the northern part of the Chula Valley. Okay. That helps. It's before they drained it. So, just lost my place. Hang on. They built up the city and they lived there. So that's it. Dun settles in. Dun. And they called the city Dun. Isn't that sweet? Bishem Dun Abihem, for their ancestor Dun, in case you got confused. Asher Yuladeli Yisrael, the one who was born to Yisrael.
Is there another one?
Jacob.
Is there
right.
Another one? There...
Is there somebody else? Why do you need to tell me that? Is a good question. V'ulam Laish Shem Ha'ir L'Rishona, but the city had originally been called Laish. Okay. V'yakimu Lahem B'nei Dan Es Hapasel. And they set up the statue, of course. V'yahonasan Ben Gershom Ben, what's the next word?
Moshe.
Unclear. Unclear. Depends on your edition.
Was Moshe's son. Mm-hmm.
That's part of the problem here. The word is written Mem Nun Shin Hey, but the Nun is above the line.
Yeah. Where was it? Was that in the scrolls? Is that how it's
if you have a scroll of Shoftim, you will see it written that way, inserted above the line, as though it's a superscript. We're going to talk about what that means, obviously. That's not something we're going to just leave that way. But Yonasan, son of Gershom, son of Menashe, we think, who Ubanav, he and his kids, Hayu Kohanim, Leshevet Hadani, Ad Yom Gilos Haaretz. They remained as priests for the tribe of Dan until the day when the Jews, well, the day when someone was exiled from the land. We'll see. Vayasimu lahem es pesal micha asher asa. And they established the idol of Micha that he had made. Kol yimei heyos beis ha-Elokim b'shilo. And that was so as long as the house of Elokim, this is the house of God, was in Shilo. That's the Mishkan that we had. As long as the Mishkan was in Shilo, which is a very long time, the Mishkan is in Shilo until the time of Shmuel, they're doing this. Sorry?
It sounds like it wasn't idol worship, according to, like, it seems to
wasn't,
me.
Wasn't.
I feel like they're...
Because?
Like, I don't know, it just... They had Yonatan, they had,
You mean because they have somebody who they think is,
And they said, okay, so maybe Shiloh was far, so this is their,
Right. Could be. It's possible. Shiloh was not as far from where they lived originally. Yeah. Although, keep in mind, Dan wasn't going to set it up. It was Micha who set it up. Micha sets it up in Har Ephraim, which is not far from Shiloh. So yeah, they don't have that excuse of it being, I mean, look, everybody thinks, shul is too far, I have a house minion on my block. But realistically, it should have been, the excuse of it's too far is weird. There's a lot here that requires explanation. Let's go back to the beginning of this passage here and the burning the city. So I gave you on your sheets Ralbag, source number one. V'yidmeh, and this was Ricky had said this as well, V'yidmeh she'sarfu ha'ir ba'esh k'dei she'yira'u yoshevei she'ar ha'ayaros asher naflu b'gor olam mayhem. They burned the city so that the residents of the other cities in this area would be afraid. And then v'yinatzchum b'kalut yoter, and they would defeat them more easily, mitzad nefol pachdam aleihem, because they would become afraid. So keep in mind, we have this classic debate as to whether Laish was part of Dun's portion in the first place or not. Ralbag seems to believe that it is part of Dun's portion. The weakness of saying it's part of Dun's portion, we said this last time, is that it's on the other side of the Jordan. Right? And we already have said in the Chumash we said it, and in Yoshua we said it, it's only Reuven, Gad, and part of Menashe that are on the eastern side of the Yarden. So it's hard to maintain that, but that's Ralbag's view. And Ralbag says, so they're thinking prospectively. We want to conquer more land in our portion, and therefore we want to intimidate everybody. Burning the city will intimidate everybody.
Who's everybody? Yeah. Can we just say that there was nobody around?
No,
maybe there's a small town here, a small town there, or something.
What about the Israel portion, like the Plishtim area there? The word gets to them, because they couldn't conquer that.
Would word get back to them? That's interesting. I don't think they're focused on that, though.
They all left there? Like, no one's left in that area?
There is, but these people took their families with them. Like, they're expecting, this is our new home. So that's hard. Radak offers two other explanations in source number two. He says, V'yitachen, it could be, ki kshenichnesu b'nei Dan ba'ir pit'om nichnesu. It could be that when Dan entered the city, they did so suddenly. Ki heim lo hayu margishim, v'lo hayu nishmarim mehem. Right? It's a surprise attack. The people are betach, they're secure, they feel like everything is fine. And so the city is unaware. V'shalchu esh ba'ir lahav heal ha'am. And so what they wanted to do was press that advantage and frighten everybody. V'lo yi epnai la'adam la'shiv milchama b'in ha'esh v'milchama shasu lehem b'nei Dan. Between the fire and the attacks, the locals will just be panicked and they won't be able to return fire. That's the first approach of Radak. It's just a practical method. And then second, Oefshar, alternatively, Kiyaisam Maleha Gilulim. Could be the city was filled with idols, Ora said this jokingly, Ulefichach Sarfua, and therefore they burned it. Ve'aval pishe mekimwa pesel lahem, Haisah kamenasam l'shamayim. Granted, they established their own idol, they intended it for heaven, right? This is like the view that it's a syncretism type of a thing, where they really believe that this is their way to worship God, blending in the Canaanite ways with their own. Okay, so now we understand, we have a few possibilities anyway, for why they burnt the city. Intimidation, military strategy, or eliminating idolatry.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, people have multiple motivations for what they do. Nobody is there to save them. The city is renamed Dan. because of Dan, who was born to Yisrael. Why does the pasuk tell me that? Don't read ahead. Why does the pasuk tell me this? What is the message?
Well, they're trying to justify
they have the right to remind them.
To justify taking over the area? Could be.
Sometimes you, yeah, sometimes they are. To the credit or to the discredit of their ancestor, right?
Right. So in other words, now we're discrediting Dan for what his descendants did.
They have entitlement.
The sense of entitlement, like this is our land because we are descendants of Dan, who's from Yaakov, could be a sense of entitlement. I think, yeah.
It's like just to remind us that this is our people. It's still our people. It's still our Dan.
No oh, in other words, the reader. For the reader to see it and remember, you have to, you can't,
our families don't.
Right, you can't deny the fact that these are yours. These people who are doing these ridiculous things, yeah, they're actually part of your family. A message to the reader. They could be. I think a lot of it is, and just to show you, Radak says that it's Shalot Achshov Ki Rosh HaMishpacha Ahi Asher Bo L'Lai Yesh HaYashmo Dan, lest you think that it was just the head of their household was a fellow named Dan. So it's telling you that it's not so. But I think that there is an idea here that they are trying to connect to the past. That this, you know, their identity is confused. They may be doing these weird things with the statue, and they may be acting in a way that makes us look at them and say, you know, you're like the Canaanites at this point. But they think, no, we're naming this for Dan, right? You know what it reminds me of? A different level of that, you know, from this, but worth noting. The whole Maccabiah practice, right? The Maccabiah games, right? When you consider that they're named for the Maccabim, right? What would the Maccabim have thought of the Maccabiah?
Right, they were actually fighting exactly.
They're fighting the Greeks with their Greek Olympics and everything else, right? There is, it was a column in Toronto Torah a few weeks ago that we put out, that there is actually a race every year that starts from the site called Kever HaShmonaim, where the HaShmonaim are buried. There is a race that's meant to carry on the spirit of the HaShmonaim. They would not be impressed. But there's a desire, nonetheless, to connect back to our history, even if we're not quite living up to it. And I think that's what you're seeing here, is this... is this attempt to claim the mantle of their heritage, even if it doesn't make any sense. So here we are, calling it Dan, from Dan, son of Yaakov, and now, in our next pasuk, hey, let's set up an idol. Right? V'akimulem b'nei Dan, es apostle. Right? That's your next pasuk.
Is this portion mentioned later on in Shmuel or Malachim? Do they call it Dan? Like, is it...
This area? Well, the city of Dan, being up north, is named actually Chumash already. In Abraham's time, you know about it. And later on, they do talk about from Dan to Be'er Sheva as the boundaries of settlement. So yes, it's actually known as Dan from there on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could it be that they're descendants of Yisrael, not of, like, he doesn't use the name Yaakov?
That's interesting. The fact that the name Yisrael is used instead of Yaakov is definitely interesting. I haven't seen anybody pick up on it.
Yaakov's name was changed to Israel.
Thanks. Okay, thank you. Yaakov is changed to Israel, but he goes by both.
Yeah.
And it is interesting to see them pick Israel. I think, you know, you could point out that Israel is generally a name associated with military action. And it makes sense because it's given to him as the one who fought, right? So maybe that's a reason to pick Yisrael. But you're right, it's an interesting point that they choose Yisrael specifically. So we have to talk about this fellow, Yonatan ben Gershon ben Menashe. Before we do, I wanted to note that they're there with this house, Ad Yom Gilo Taaretz, right? Until the day of the exile of the land. What exile could that be?
Are they talking about the exile of 10 tribes going to Babylonia?
So, well, we just mentioned two possibilities. Mm-hmm. One, the extreme one, would be the Babylonians. That one is unlikely. The reason it's unlikely is because before the Babylonians get there, the Assyrians have already exiled the 10 northern tribes. There are no Jews there anymore. I mean, there may be one or two here and there, but the population's gone.
There's always one or two here and there.
You got it. But the Assyrians, that's one possibility. And in fact, that's Rashi's perspective. If you take a look at source number 4, it is a very long time. The Ad Yom Gilos Haaretz Bimei Sancheirev V'Golos Rishona, in the time of Sancheirev, because that's the first exile that we will come across. However, commentators are bothered by this idea. What's weak about that idea? Without reading source number 5.
It's a long time.
Well, first of all, it's a very long time for them to last. But not just that.
The country was unified until they, with King Saul and David, and before they separated, and Israel was at the north, and Judah was at the south.
Right.
So it's kind of...
But why would that mean that they couldn't have still had the temple there in the north? See, while Bag asks a basic question, we have several kings who are described in Tanakh as having campaigned against Avodah Zarah, getting rid of idols. Why would this still be there? Even if they believed that they were worshipping God in some way, it's going to be recognized by people who are mainstream. You don't worship God with statues. It's just not one of our things.
But they came too, right?
Yeah, I mean, Chizkiyahu comes along, Yoshiyahu comes along.
Because they got rid of all the idols, right?
Yeah. So why would this have remained? That's one question. Another question, Yechezkel Kaufman points out, they had a separate Bama in Dan in the days of Yeravam ben Nevat. Yeravam is the one who splits off the northern kingdom from the southern kingdom, and he sets up his own competing temples so that the Jews won't go to the Beis HaMikdash. And he set them up in Dan. Why did he need to do that?
Because it's there already.
You have one.
He builds it. He sets it up.
Was this
in Malachama?
When they talk about Atkalot Ha'aretz, till they split.
Well, that's what we're asking. That's what we're asking. That's the view that we're suggesting from Rashi.
It wasn't part of Israel. You know, you said it's outside the... Technically,
technically outside of the land, maybe. So take a look at source number 5. Well, Bach presents another idea. He says it's not a particular exile that you know of. He says Yom Galos Haaretz Lo Yitachen She'amar Al Yom Galos B'Meit Tzidkiyahu. He says it can't be Tzidkiyahu's time, which is the one under Bavel that Eti mentioned. It can't be that. Shekvar avru kama manhigim biaru avodas gilul min haaretz, because he says by then various leaders had already tried to eliminate idols from the land, kamo Shmuel, Shaul, David, and Rabbi Mesulas Tamacharei, and many others as well. V'ulam amar ad yom galos haaretz, but it says until the land was exiled, ki yitachen shegalsa haaretz hahi. It could be. It was just some random event in which, because the Jews had done things they weren't supposed to do, God causes them to be punished by some local enemy. And they're exiled until they come back later. Maybe it was in the days of Yavin. Right? Yavin was the one who Devorah fought against. Right? He was the king. And that Dun fled and they crossed the Yarden. If you remember in Shiraz Devorah, when Devorah gave her poem, a victory poem after the war, she complains about the tribes who didn't come help. And she says, "The Dun lama yagoranios, why does Dun dwell on boats?" So he says, maybe that's exactly it. Like the Pasuk says, he said, why do you reside on boats? Maybe that's what happened. Maybe they were kicked out by Yavin. And that's what it's talking about. He says, however it worked. For sure, it's before the death of Eli in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. And that's why it says that it didn't last beyond the Mishkan and Shiloh. The Mishkan and Shiloh was destroyed in the time of Eli when Shmuel is when Shmuel is just starting out. Okay, so Ralbag believes that this Gilot Haaretz is not one of the named exiles. It's just some random time, possibly from Yavin Melech Canaan, unclear. That's his approach. One more approach is found in Radak and Abarbanel. And they say, no, it's specifically what happened in the time of Eli, when the Plishtim destroyed the Mishkan. That's exactly it. And it fits the psukim very nicely. Source number 6. Midera hasvara nira. Logically, it appears. Ki ad yom galos ha'aretz hu yom shegala ha'aron. It's logical to say that the day when the land was exiled means when the Aron, the Ark of God, was exiled. V'apasuk ha'achar shenemar kan gam kein mochef. He says you can prove it from the next pasuk, because it says that this was here as long as the house of God was in Shiloh. So it makes sense.
So they're referring to something that happened so far ahead.
Well, what bothers us about that? What bothers us about it? This is not a prediction. This is not. This is the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. This is the great. Or it's Ein Shoftim, we credit to Shmuel. So Shmuel knows already about the destruction of the Mishkan in Shiloh. Right. He sees it. So either it's Shmuel who's writing this in, or the ultimate canonizers, the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, are including it. Either way. But yeah, that would be the way to look at it.
I have a problem with this.
Yeah.
The Gnut Haaretz, which is the exile of the people up north of Israel.
We assume.
Yeah.
He doesn't
but
think
he's
so.
Talking about now Shiloh.
Correct.
Which was to the south.
Correct.
So and the Mishkan was in Shiloh, was not up there.
Correct. So no, what he's doing is he's claiming that because the next pasuk talks about Shiloh, maybe this is the reference here in this pasuk. But you're right, that's the weakness in this answer, is Gilot Haaretz, it doesn't sound like you should be referencing that, it sounds like you should be saying it was here until the Jews were kicked out.
Right.
Yeah, no, understood. Each of the answers is fundamentally dealing with a problem, right? Rashi, perhaps, is dealing with a problem that it says Gilot Haaretz, that should mean when they leave, right? But Radak is dealing with the problem that it would have been gone long before the Assyrians ever showed up. So each one is trying to, and Rabag is trying to satisfy both by saying it's just some random galut. Doesn't, you know, we don't even know about it necessarily. Okay.
Is the Pesel Micha ever discussed in Shmuel or Malachi?
No.
We never hear about it again.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it would be more like the last one. It sounds like before.
It stopped in the beginning of Shmuel, and therefore there's no. Yeah, could be. They could be.
But it's possible that this vessel was destroyed when one of the kings decided to clean up the country.
The problem is that Yom Gilot Haaretz doesn't sound like it. Gilot Haaretz sounds like when they were removed.
But it's not saying that the pesel was not removed before.
No, because it's saying the pesel was there. No, it's describing the pesel, not that. Look, it says, go back to Pasuklam, but Kimo lehem b'nei dan et ha-pasel, b'nei dan set up the idol. And this fellow Yehonatan, he and his kids were Kohanim for Shevet Dan until the day of Gilot Haaretz. So what were they Kohanim if the pesel is gone?
Well, you could, like the other people, they pray to God without the pesel.
Could be. Could be. I'm not so compelled. But yeah. Okay. So that concludes the story. Dan wins. Right? Dan wins. They get the land they wanted. They massacred the local residents. They stole an idol. They stole a Kohen, who was really a Levi. Right? And Micha's out of luck. But that's okay, because, you know, I mean, he was a bad guy to begin with, right? So fine. I'm okay with that. This business with Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe / Moshe. So here we need to take a few minutes to understand what in the world is going on. The problems that we have here in Pasuk Lamed. There are a few problems here in Pasuk Lamed. Obviously, the most glaring problem is... The most glaring problem in this sentence is the nun. Right? Why is the nun above the line? We have three other cases in Tanakh in which a letter is written above the line. One in Tehillim, two in Iyov. I gave you the reference, I think. No, I didn't. I mean, in the interest of space, I didn't do it. Because I wanted to fit everything on one page. So, sorry I did not, but I'll tell it to you. In Tehillim Perek Hey, the 80th chapter in Tehillim, the Pasuk says, Yikar Simena Chazir Mi Ya'ar, the Chazir, the boar, or the pig, will consume it, will cut it, from the Ya'ar, from the forest. The Ayin in Miya'ar is suspended above the line. And there, the Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Lamed, says that's because it's the midpoint of Tehillim. In order to show this is the midpoint of Tehillim, the Ayin is above the line. It's weird, but not unprecedented. We have in Parsha Shmini, the Nun in Kol Holech Al Gachon is a large final Nun, and we're told it's because it's the midpoint in the Chumash. So it's not unprecedented to do that, and there are other parallels between Tehillim and Chumash, which are a longer discussion. But think of the five books and the five.
Do they count the words, the letters?
Sorry.
How do they know it's the midpoint? Do they count the words?
So they must have counted. They must have counted. I haven't tried.
So when this was written, that means that there was already a knowledge, a pre-knowledge of how long it's going to be when it reaches
Tehillim, for sure.
Tehillim, yes, but
it's only Tehillim that you have it for, and Chumash.
It was written in one unit.
No, just the opposite. Tehillim is accumulated. Tehillim, we're told in the Gemara, there are 10 different authors for Tehillim. So it's assembled, and whoever assembles it decides we're putting this letter above the line.
So that's about the Nun, as you said, about the Nun. Where is that?
So the Nun, Kol Halecha Gachon in Shmini, God's the author. So God presumably knows how many letters he's going to have. But that's the easy one.
Perek
Pei. Chapter 80, sentence 14. You can look in your mini edition to see if they put it above the line, but I don't know if you'd
sure.
be able to tell.
You might not yet.
The others are in Iyov Perek Lamed Chet. Iyov chapter 38, sentences 13 and 15. The word Rishaim is written with the ayin above the line so that it can be read as rashim. Rashim are those who are poor or beset by others, attacked by others. Rishaim are wicked. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Dakuf Gimel Amid Beis, explains there's a special meaning to why it's written that way. I don't want to go into it because we have too much to discuss here, but they see special meaning in that. You might have looked at this and said, it's simply a scribal correction of a mistake. Right? It should have said Menashe, it didn't, and it said Moshe, so he went back and he stuck in a Nun. But at what point in our history did we have only one book of Shoftim such that everybody would then thereafter copy this one and copy the error?
Some copied one way and some the other, and then they didn't know which way to go, so they did it.
And it's just, it's weird to me. That suggestion is very strange to me. Interestingly, Yechezkel Kaufman notes that the Aramaic versions of Shoftim, you know, that we don't just have Onkelos on Chumash. We have various Aramaic commentaries both to Chumash and to Navi, Targum Yonatan being on Navi, among others. So he says various Targumim, some of them have Moshe and some of them have Menashe. So some went one way, some went the other way. But that's one problem with this. It's the most glaring problem with this. But what else is odd about this name?
Voila.
Sorry, TK, what? Why does he get three generations?
Usually
we only mention three generations for somebody if they're a celebrity. There's something. No, seriously, we don't. Otherwise, why in the... I mean, of all the people in Tanakh, I don't know what to call him. He's just like the fellow who just in pursuit of a job, who lucked out into a job in this house of Micha, and lucked out into a job with Dunn, right? And who's running after I don't know what, career advancement. This is the guy?
Social climber?
Yeah. This is the guy. And not only that, right? Not only that, but I'll ask the other question. Why is this name here at the end? Why has he been the Levi, the Levi, the Levi, the Levi, and suddenly he has a name?
This is the Yonatan guy?
Yeah. Oh. We've been reading about him for two chapters, and he's just been the Levi, the Nar, the Levi, the Nar. What happened to, you know, Yonatan in the first place?
Well, now he became a
fortune.
We're not giving him any credit. Sorry. No. So this is really weird. So one piece of evidence that we have that we can work with, we don't know of anyone in Tanakh named Gershom ben Menashe, but we do know Gershom ben Moshe. Right? He is very familiar. He's Moshe's son. Not only that, this story, according to most chronologies, only happens about 30 years after we enter Israel. prisoner. Moshe's grandson, alive and well. Right? There's no reason to think otherwise. So, with that in mind, let's take a look at the Gemara in Bava Basra in source number 7. It's a long piece, but very worth taking apart. Hopefully we'll finish it all today. This first part of the Gemara we already saw. Right? We cited this earlier. The Gemara is bothered by a completely separate point. The Gemara is discussing how we record lineage in Tanakh, and do we record the mother's family, and is the mother's family meaningful? Because it's bothered by the fact that when the Levi is first introduced to us, we are told he is a Levi, and we are told he's from Yehuda. And so the question is, so which is it? So Hagufa Kasha, the Gemara says, this is itself contradictory. Amridvahu Levi says he's a Levi. Alami Levi Asi, that means he comes from Levi. Mimishpachas Yehuda, he's from the family of Yehuda. Alami Yehuda Asi, so he's from Yehuda. Which is it? Elalav de Avua mi Levi ve'eme mi Yehuda. Uko Amar Mimishpachas Yehuda. See that? His father's a Levi. His mother's from Yehuda. And yet it lists him as being from Yehuda. That shows that maternal lineage matters. To which Amar Rava Bar Rav Chanan Lo says, no, Gavra Dishmei Levi. It's just some guy whose name was Levi. To which the Gemara says, you can't do that. I know his name. Right? It says, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. His name is Yonatan. So Amar Le, he says back to him, Vali Tameich. I'm skipped a couple of lines in the Hebrew because they're not germane for us immediately. But he says in Vli Tamech, well, according to you, V'chi ben Menashe, who? Is he really the son of Menashe? V'halo ben Moshe. He's the son of Moshe. Dichsiv, as the Pasuk says, B'nei Moshe Gershom Be'eliezer. Right? We know Moshe has a son Gershom. I don't know why you need that Pasuk. We have other Pasukim with Gershom, but alright. El mitoch sha'asa maisa Menashe. The answer is he's really Moshe's son. But it's written Menashe in the Pasuk because Menashe was a king who led the Jews into idolatry. He is like Menashe. And then they say maybe that's why we say he's from Yehuda. Not because he's biologically from Yehuda, but because Menashe came from Yehuda. Which is a very difficult line. We talked about that already earlier on. I'm not going to go back to that. The Maharal actually has a comment on that. But Amar Yochanan Bishomar Bishomar Bayochai Mikan Shetolin as Haklala b'Mekulkal. You see that we link corruption with the corrupt. So we say he's Yonatan son of Gershom son of Menashe, even though there's no biological relationship, just because he's like Menashe. So the first part of the Gemara says, you know what? He is actually from Moshe. And their evidence for saying so is just because we know there is a Gershom son of Moshe. So Menashe isn't really his name. Then the Gemara goes further. We are now, if you're using the Hebrew, we're on the flip side. Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar said, La'olam yidbak adam betovim. You should always stick to good people. Marry into a good family. Shari Moshe shenasa bas paro, yatsami manu yahonasan. Because he says, Moshe marries the daughter of Yisro, who originally was a priest for Avodah Zarah, and he ends up with this Levi. Aaron, Shanasa Bas Aminadav. Aaron, on the other hand, marries Elisheva, daughter of Aminadav, Yatsi Menu Pinchas. And he got Pinchas as a descendant. You see that? Marry good people, and your kids will do well. Magic. Magic. Pinchas Lav Mi Yisro Asi, to which the Gemara says, wait a minute. We actually have a tradition that Pinchas is also from Yisro. Not just this side, the other side too. V'aksiv, ve'elazar ben Aaron lakach lo mi benos Putiel lo li'isha. Because the Pasuk says that Elazar, son of Aaron, married from the daughters of Putiel. So Putiel, the Gemara says, means Yisro, shepitem agalim la'avodah zarah. He fattened calves for idolatry. So which they say, no, Putiel may be Yisro, maybe Yosef, not Yisro. It's a longer discussion, but fundamentally, they take the view here that he is from Yisro. We're going to come back to the Yisro link. But right now, that's the assumption. You know how Moshe got an idolater grandson? It was because of the other side of the family. They blame the in-laws. Right. But we're not done. Amrulo. Now we come back to something we read earlier. I talked about the three questions that they asked him, and it was bizarre. They asked him three questions that were all essentially the same. What are you doing here? Right? So we were bothered then. So the Gemara says, Amrullah, they said to him, Lav mi Moshe ka'asis. Each of their questions was, aren't you from Moshe? Because the wording of their questions matched wording seen with Moshe. The question, the first question that they asked was, the first question that they asked him was, when they first saw him there. Sorry? Right, thank you. The mi haviyacha halom. The word halom is an odd word. Happens to be a word that God uses with Moshe. Al tikrav halom. The second, it was Perek Yudchet Pasuk Gimel. Chapter 18, sentence 3. Ma ata oseh bazeh? Well, that's reminiscent of ma zeh biyadecha. That's the weakest of the three. And then they said, malacha fo. Well, fo, vata poa modi madi, Hashem said to Moshe. So the Gemara says, they're really asking him, aren't you Moshe's grandson? What are you doing as a priest for Avodah Zarah? So they strengthen the Moshe link with the language from that pasuk, which leads us to his defense. Amar lahen, he said to them, Kach mikublani mi beis avi abba. I have a tradition from the house of my grandfather. La'olam yah, meaning Moshe. La'olam yaskir adam atzmo la'avodah zarah va'al yitzdarech lebrios. Better to hire yourself out for avodah zarah rather than need the support of others. I needed a parnasa. This was a job.
He learned that from Moshe?
That's what he says. I got it from Moshe. We're going to see what he means soon. But that's what he was saying, and that's how he became a careerist. It's like, well, look, I got to support myself. V'hu savar la'avodah zarah mamash. He thought that was literal. Moshe literally said to him, go worship idols. V'lohi ela avodah zarah means avodah shazara lo. Avodah zarah doesn't mean idolatry. Avodah zarah means strange worship or strange service. Avodah, which is zarah, means don't stand on ceremony and say, I am Moshe's grandson, I can't take a menial job. Even take on work that is beneath you in order to be able to support yourself. Kedamar le Rav Rav Kahana, like Rav's advice for Rav Kahana, Netosh Nevelta Veshuka Ushkol Agra. You should throw carcasses in the marketplace and get paid to do that. Velo Tema Gava Rabba Anavazila Bimilson. Don't say, I'm a great man and this is degrading for me. Get yourself a job. Whatever the job is, that's what you do. So that's what Moshe tried to tell him, but he misunderstood it. He misunderstood what he had been told. Avodah Zarah. Oh, okay. They, Kevan Sherah David, but the story isn't done. We then conclude with a very interesting passage. There's a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim Aleph, which we're going to reference here, in which David gives somebody a job overseeing otsarot, storehouses. The name there is Shavuel, son of Gershom, son of Menashe. So the Gemara says, Kevan Shira David Shamamon Chaviv Alav Biyoser. David saw that this fellow really liked money. Mina Al Haotzaros. He put him in charge of the storehouses, quoting this pasuk. And they say, well, what do you mean? His name is Yehonatan, not Shavuel. To which he says, no. Rabbi Yochanan says, Sheshav Lakel Bechol Libo. He returned to God with all his heart, and you get a sort of happy ending. What this is really about is a drasha on the triple name. Here it's Yehonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe slash Moshe. There we have a Shavuel son of Gershom son of Menashe, and attempting to link the two because it's so odd to see these links. Yes, I know, David is much, much later than this story. You know, for him to have lived that long is strange. Not unprecedented, but strange. Okay. So the big question that remains for us, now that we read through this Gemara, is, what are you talking about? That's the question you still have to ask here. I mean, I understand now what the Gemara is doing. That's not a small thing. I understand what the Gemara is trying to accomplish. The Gemara is trying to solve problems in biblical text. Okay? I have a name here, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe slash Moshe. I don't understand why he has three names recorded for him here. I don't understand why the name comes in at the end of the story. And I don't understand. I don't. Why does a guy like this? You know. Why? I'm sorry. No. Why does he? Why does he get three names? But why is the nun suspended above the line? And so what the Gemara is suggesting is this is Moshe's grandson. And to fill in the blanks on this, because I don't think I spelled it out fully, we get the nun suspended because we don't want to embarrass Moshe. We have this idea of being like Menashe, but also we don't want to embarrass Moshe. Like, we need to come out with this story here and say Moshe's grandson is this, you know, this kid. And in addition to that, we don't want to embarrass him by putting it up front in the story. It will get mentioned, because the lesson has to be learned, but bury it at the end. Don't put it up front in the beginning. So that's why this happened. However, what we haven't explained yet is, why did this happen? How does, I mean, I understand the Yisro influence idea that the Gemara is presenting, but Yisro left Avodah Zarah. He left idolatry behind. Are you really going to tell me that's an excuse? Like, that explains how it is that Moshe's grandson ends up with idolatry? I have a hard time with that. So what we're going to have to do next time, because we're already at our limit here, what we're going to have to do next time is see the last sources here, the Gemara, Nedarim, and the Mechilta. I will bring them on the sheet, God willing, next time, to discuss different approaches to what it was that went wrong with Moshe's grandson, if this could really be him. Linda, what?
Oh, I can't even say it. But yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. What I will say, I guess I should say, it's important to say, is that parents have no guarantees about what their children are going to do. This is absolutely true.
Or the grandchildren.
Or the grandchildren.
And so many great people, even today.
Also true.
They all, you know.
The other way also works.
Not all. The ones you know.
There's a lot of lineages from rabbis that their children are all brilliant, like, you know.
No.
Yeah.
We have no guarantees. You can do everything, so to speak, right. You can do everything by the book, and you won't get what you expected. And
the other way also
life.
Works. Yes, you can be a simple person, and your offspring can
also true. Very true. But let's next time be back here, please, and we'll see more about this. Thank you.